Hi, I'm Shahid Hamid, and I want to invite you to a very special 8-hour Memorial Day Soul and Rhythm and Blues experience right here on KBOO 90.7 FM from 12 o'clock noon to 8 p.m. with JJ leading us off from 12 noon to 2 o'clock, followed by Sequoyna Wright from 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock p.m., followed by yours truly, Shahid, from 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m., and Reggae Bob taking us home from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock p.m., from the old to the new, just for you, a very special Memorial Day Soul and Rhythm and Blues experience. Monday, May the 26th, 12 noon to 8 p.m., right here on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM, and online, www.kboo.fmradio.
The time is 6:30, Monday, May 19th, 2014. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next on KBOO, it's Prison Pipeline.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime, and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. Tonight I am joined by Jessica Katz and Aaron Webb with the Family Preservation Project at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, Oregon's only women's prison. We're also joined by Eva Guzman, who recently released from Coffee Creek. So we'll talk about how the Family Preservation Project helps connect women in custody with their children. Welcome, Jessica, Aaron, and Eva.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, Jessica, you are the founder of the Family Preservation Project. Tell us about that.
When I did my graduate work, I was in New York, and I had the opportunity to work with a family law clinic through the law school at the university. And I had the opportunity to go into prisons in New York and talk about and teach classes about the legal rights of parents. But I wanted to be a lawyer, and then I discovered that was not my cup of tea, and I wanted to work with people in a different way. And I moved back to Oregon, and I was alerted that, hey, there's this job at a prison, and you should really apply for it. And that was 11 years ago. But I'm a social worker by training and also at heart, and I found that prison is really where all of our failures as a society sort of come to rest. It's where you see all of the failings, and they're all here in one place, and so it's just an incredible opportunity to look at those. The program started 11 years ago as a federally funded family literacy program, and about 8 years ago we lost that funding, but saw that the need was immense at Coffee Creek for this type of programming. And so we were able to redesign the program and then went out to seek financial support to continue doing the work that we were doing at Coffee Creek. And we were the first program of that kind to ever be in a correctional facility. So there was lots to figure out about being able to really deliver the services that we were being asked to deliver with the barriers that we were facing.
So Jessica and Aaron, you both work with the Family Preservation Project. Talk about your roles or your positions at Coffee Creek.
So I coordinate the program, which essentially we have a staff now of four and an intern. So my role is to coordinate the work of the program, to look at the program design, to try to find financial support and other sorts of support to continue doing the work that we do. So because we are a small program, we serve a small amount of women. We all are pretty hands-on in terms of working with women. We have classes 2 days a week, plus on every first and third Saturday, the women get to spend 3 hours with their kids outside of the visiting environment. In addition to that, we work with women every week in individual appointments to help them. Our mode of working with the women is really to look at the family piece. So both where you came from, identify the strengths from your family system, from your family of origin, identify those things that you want to continue as traditions with your family, and look at those things that maybe not so much. You don't want to repeat those patterns, to start to begin to envision a life that is worth living and one that you deserve. And that's really the essence of our work.
And Aaron, as family advocate with the Family Preservation Project, what is your role?
my primary focus is on the children. Currently, we have 16 children enrolled in the program, but it's been up to about 25 in the past. It just depends on how many children the individual mothers have. And I focus on connecting the mothers with the children's teachers to try to involve the mothers in the children's education as much as possible, because we know that that helps the child succeed. And for many of the mothers, they've never had any contact with teachers before. So we start by sending an introduction letter to the teacher from the mother via email through me, and then we set up a conference by phone. And we prepare the mothers for the conference so they know what questions to ask and what to expect. And generally, they're very nervous going in because they've never gone to a conference before, and they expect maybe some judgment from the teachers, but that doesn't happen at all. And in the end, they're very relieved. And because of that experience, we believe they're more likely to be involved in the future with their children's education and to start to understand their role in it and how important that is. Another thing that I do is work to find any services the children may need. I partner with the caregiver and the mother to figure out what may need to happen. In the case of Eva's family, we provided tutoring for her older son for at least a year, which was very helpful for him. And we provide enrichment services for the children, gymnastics classes, summer camp. So a big part of what I do is work with the families to coordinate that and figure out what the family wants to do, and then we cover the cost of it. I also work hands-on with the moms. Friday, we have a parent education class that I facilitate, and I facilitate the Saturday program. The moms take turns planning the activities, and I found that really helped engage them in the process, where I used to just do it for them. They were a little checked out. Now they take turns planning, and they also discover that they have an ability to meet their children's developmental needs and figure out some fun things for them to do, and that's primarily what I do.
So, Eva, you were recently released from Coffee Creek. When were you released?
I was released in August 2013.
You completed the Family Preservation Project?
Yes, I did.
So tell us about that experience.
The Family Preservation Project, I got involved. I was involved with them for about 3-4 years. And it was, for me, it was a growth, an experience. It brought me back with my kids. It brought me back with my father. I was able to deal with personal issues and education. They paid for college correspondence courses through Idaho State to help me with my education. They got me into computer classes, and they helped me communicate with my kids and the kids' teachers, so I was active in their schoolwork and knowing what their grades were and what their IPOs were and just what they needed in school in general from me. And I was able to have conferences or meetings with my family, so we could talk about their worries with me and my worries with them, what's going on with the kids.
And Eva, how many children do you have?
I have 3.
And were you involved with your children when you went to prison?
Yes, I was. I was pregnant when I went to prison with my daughter. I had my daughter 11 days after I got to prison. I was involved with my son. My youngest son was in DHS custody at that time.
How old were they when you went to prison?
My oldest son was 6. My youngest son was 2. And I was still pregnant with my daughter.
And talk about when you had your daughter in prison. What was that like?
It was scary. I had my daughter. They didn't get me to the hospital right away. They wanted to make sure that I was having my daughter. And I'm not supposed to have kids naturally. And when they found that out, they rushed me to the hospital. And 2 days later, I had to pass my daughter out the door. She went back to her dad. They had me chained to a bed the whole time. The women at the hospital treated me bad. They didn't want me to have my daughter in my room with me. But the guard actually made sure that my daughter was in there with me.
Anecdotally, over the 11 years, what I've heard over and over again from women is how and where their children were used against them or to the benefit of, you know, the criminal justice system as a pawn or as a tool or as a vehicle to have women comply with either accepting plea bargains that may be not so good through the arrest process. And then, you know, from there, what happens? And what, you know, to be a criminal is bad. To be a mother who's a criminal is the worst, because there's a lot of demonization of these women, not for just breaking the law, but for also then being bad mothers. Doesn't matter what kind of mother they may have been. The assumption is they made choices, therefore that equals bad mother because their choices were not in the best interest of their children.
And you talked about plea bargaining. What about within the prison itself? Ava, could you address that?
Often there are guards that will even bring up our children or the us being in there and being women with children. They'll use that against us, you know, us being bad mothers, or we wouldn't have made the choices that we made if we really cared about our kids. Even during my arrest, when I was first arrested, you know, they knew that my son was in DHS custody, and they, you know, the officers would use threats such as I would never see my son again. And they also knew that I was pregnant during the time that I was arrested, that they would make sure that I would never see my daughter, that, you know, it's leverage. It's all about leverage to get what they want.
And what are the numbers at Coffee Creek? How many women are in custody at Coffee Creek, and how many are mothers?
So I think the last number I saw was around 1,300 women. We've done some surveying of the minimum population. We did not do this over on the medium side, but the numbers of women who are parenting were up to about 90%.
90% women in Coffee Creek are mothers.
At least on the minimum side.
So there's a minimum and medium security at Coffee Creek.
Right.
So what programs are available at Coffee Creek for women who come to prison pregnant and deliver while in prison?
There's an early Head Start program from birth to 3 years old. And if you have any kids over that age, they're not eligible for the program. If you're in max custody and you're pregnant and you have a baby, if you have more than 4 years, you won't be eligible for that program because early Head Start and FPP are only in minimum custody.
How many women are eligible or in the Head Start program?
Eight women.
And in the Head Start program, Eva, how often did you see your newborn baby?
Twice a week.
How does a baby connect with its mother with two weekly visits?
So a focus of our program is either building the bond from the beginning in the case of when a child is born in prison. Other families, there was the bond there. The mother was in an active parenting role, and Eva was parenting her other children, and there was a bond there. So in that case, we're just reinforcing, strengthening the bond and allowing for consistent visitation, and they can see their parent. And it also helps the mother bond with the children and have hope again. They talk a lot about having hope again for the first time, and they believe in their ability to be a good parent for the first time. The level of shame and guilt that they experience when they first get in there, some of them are not able to rise out of it and even ask for help or advocate for themselves.
There were some complications, some other issues that were personal that prevented me to keep going to early Head Start. So I had to withdraw from that program, and it took me about a year to see my daughter again. And the only way that was eligible or applicable to me was I had gotten into the Family Preservation Program. And with that, I was accepted with all of my kids.
If you just tuned in, I am here speaking with Jessica Katz, Aaron Webb with the Family Preservation Project at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, and with Eva Guzman, who completed the Family Preservation Project. So, Eva, how did the Family Preservation Project help you reconnect with your daughter?
They taught me how to not only deal with my own emotional reaction to the situation, but how to slowly work my way back into it, how to give her room and let her come to me, and how I should go to her. And if she was crying, how I could better handle myself to react to her needs, not just mine, but her needs. And how to also bring my kids into it, because my son didn't know how to, he didn't understand it. He was like, Nye, that's mom. You know, that's mom. Why are you crying? And she didn't know who I was. So how to progress my son also into it, to where he would know how to deal with it himself and work together.
Eva, I hope this is okay to say, because I'm about to reveal a deep, dark secret of yours.
Okay.
But I think it's relevant.
Let's go for it.
Okay. So I was very happy that Eva introduced herself today as Eva, because when we met Eva, Eva called herself Eva, and we were to call her Eva. And the story behind that was that she was named after her grandmother, who she held in very high esteem. And she, at the time we met, was so marred in guilt and shame that she couldn't call herself by the name of a woman that she revered deeply. So she had to put a twist on her name and call herself Eva. And so what I think happens, and why I wanted to talk a little bit about this demonization of women who become involved in the criminal justice system, is that that is so alive and so well. And that's the work that we do, and I think that's part of the work that is incredibly important. The bonding work, yes, is incredibly important, but there is no child without a parent. Children don't live in isolation, so children live in relationship to somebody else. And the most important person, I believe, is their mother. And their mother has to be well and has to be whole and has to truly overcome the guilt and the shame that goes with being a mother who's incarcerated, to be able to even begin being present, to do the bonding. So you have to sort of back the whole story up, and which is why I wanted to discuss how parenthood is alive and well in the discussion from arrest onward.
So Jessica, almost 1,300 women at Coffee Creek, about 90% are moms, and yet these programs are serving a handful of women. And how many women are actually not connected with their children?
Yeah, so over the course of the 11 years, we've been committed as a program to doing research every year on our outcomes. And we've been deeply committed to having some sort of understanding about that. And so at this point in time, we have a good idea that our interventions are effective and that the outcomes are good. And I think the story now is we know what happens with intervention. But what happens when nothing happens? What happens to the majority of these women? What happens to the majority of their children without them having the good fortune to participate in these programs that serve so few women? We know that the need is greater than our capacity to serve. And so we have recently started two new initiatives at Coffee Creek. One is a speakers bureau, so that monthly we're bringing in speakers from the outside and inviting the entire population in. We're focusing those topics around parenting issues and around ways that women can become effective advocates and get support around their transition. And the ability to come to those aren't tied to anything. It's just your interest. If you're interested in coming, you can come. We have a capacity of about 150 women that can come at a time. We've also started a family resource center, which is staffed by the women in our program. And it's a way that they can sort of pay forward what they've had the good fortune to get in terms of support and advocacy and offer that to other women. And oftentimes what we find is in the matter of one phone call or in the matter of a letter, and obviously the women who are incarcerated can't use the computer and they have a lot of restrictions around using the phone. So these are facilitated by our staff and then the women who also help run this program. But the trajectory of people's lives, of women's lives, of children's lives can really truly be changed sometimes in the matter of one phone call or one letter or one connection that's made. So the interventions through the Family Resource Center are not nearly as deep as the ones through the Family Preservation Project, but we're attempting to make a big impact with a limited amount of resources.
So Eva, talk about some of these other barriers that exist for women who want to maintain a healthy relationship with their children during incarceration.
Well, a big part of it is mail and phone calls. That's a huge part of it. You know, when you're working or you first started off, you get anywhere between $4 to $7, and you have all the hygiene that you need to buy. It's not given to you. You have other things that you need to get, paper, envelopes with stamps, and nothing's really cheap. So if you can't make a phone call, you need to be able to reach out and write. And sometimes you can't do that. You can't afford it in there.
Did they have video telephoning down at Coffee Creek?
Before I released, they had gotten video visits. So women and families could connect, but it costs. It costs. And for people who don't have any money on their books, it's very limited. It's really expensive to do it. And a lot of families, a lot of older people, they don't know how to work the computer systems like that to enable themselves to do a video visit.
So Erin, talk about women in custody who want to connect with their children are not eligible for these programs, or these programs are so limited that there's no room for them. What other options do these women have for connecting or maintaining a relationship with their children?
So the women primarily have to rely on the caregivers of the children to bring them for visits.
And who is that? Who are the caregivers?
The caregivers are generally grandparents, fathers, foster parents. Many of the children end up in foster care primarily because the mother's there for 15 months or more, and that's the length of time that they need to find permanency for the children. So just based on the amount of time, the plan becomes termination of parental rights, and there's nothing that the mothers can do about that. They have some chance if they can get into a program like ours and we can help them advocate, but pretty much it just happens without them. They have a very hard time connecting with the DHS caseworkers. The caseworkers have to be willing to answer the phone and communicate with them and bring the kids in. There's barriers to that. Some caseworkers are very committed to doing it and find the way through the barriers and make it happen. Others basically withhold the children for, you know, I've heard stories of, you know, up to a year or longer until they lose their rights and it's over. So in order to see the children, they're dependent on people from the outside to bring them or allow them to talk on the phone. There's also a very big process of getting people on the visiting list. It takes a long time. It takes a long time to get people approved to be on the phone. The person from the outside has to do it, and that can be tricky for them to navigate the system to get themselves registered so they can accept a phone call. And there's a lot of barriers to communicating with the outside. That's a number one thing that we do is we help remove those barriers. We set up phone calls twice a month to the families and the children from our office, and we mail things. We have an agreement with DOC to mail things from our office in connection to the family and the children for the moms for free. That's huge. We also provide, you know, access to the children directly when they come and the families through the family meetings. But the women who have none of this are the ones that are just left feeling hopeless, powerless, and completely dependent on people on the outside to give them access to their children. Often there's a problem because they've burned that bridge and that relationship is broken. They're not with the father of the child anymore. There's hostility, animosity. Sometimes they can get court order, a judge to order visitation, but then they have a hard time getting that enforced from inside there.
Talk about some of the other things that the Family Preservation Project provides for family members on the outside.
We need to involve the whole family to create change and work on this intergenerational peace. And so we found that it was crucial to provide the family meetings for the relationship repair work to happen outside of the visiting room in a quiet room with one of our staff present, taking notes, working on whatever agreement the family members come up with that they can sign and both take with them. Often the agreements are around co-parenting issues or what transition is going to look like. But it's also a time for apologies to happen and some healing to happen in that relationship. And without that peace, we're not really healing the entire situation. And we're not impacting change in the way that we need to. So we found that it's crucial to do these meetings, and we're fortunate enough to have a part-time staff who was our intern through PSU, the MSW program. Her name's Jennifer Clark, and she facilitates the meetings. It's a passion of hers to do this kind of mediation work, and she also staffs the caregiver support group, so she's able to form relationships with the caregivers there, so maybe they will trust her. The caregivers are not the ones in prison, and it can take a little while to engage them in our program. And sometimes it's not a club they want to belong to. They don't identify with being, you know, a parent of someone in prison. But over time, they start to understand that they're all just people in the same situation and they can support each other. And we also provide a caregiver support breakfast where they can go and informally just talk to each other, get breakfast. Our staff are there to help. They can sit down and talk, and they can take a nap if they want to. They can pay bills. They can do whatever they need to during that time. It's respite for them. It's 3 hours of a break from a parenting role that they didn't ask for, but now they're responsible for children for, you know, up to 5 years, and they need support. So the other way we can support them, besides providing access to the mothers through the meetings and the caregiver support group, is financial assistance with things like tutoring and summer camp and enrichment opportunities for the children that they otherwise would not be able to afford, that their own children, the mothers in our program, didn't get those opportunities growing up. And so it's another way to impact that intergenerational peace, to be able to help with that and give the grandchild a step up.
Jessica, can we talk about what changes children face as their mothers go to prison? And what are the benefits of reunification?
People don't wake up one day and just go to prison. There's been a road, you know, that led there. So while going to prison may have been a pivotal event for the children, you have to also keep in mind that a lot of these children were living with a lot of instability. We're living with parents, mothers who were, you know, kind of deep in addiction and just trying to get by, living in poverty. And so all of those circumstances, sometimes when their mom goes to prison, it's the first sort of period of stability they have, particularly if they're in a program. They know exactly when they'll see their mom. They know that their mom is clean and sober. They know that she's present. And we joke a lot about, because we're all moms here, and we joke a lot about, you know, you will never have 3 hours with your child again where you're just totally focused on them, where the phone's not ringing, where the laundry doesn't have to be done and the dishes aren't piled up, and they're tired. You know, they're tired at the end of the 3 hours. We try to debrief and everybody's got their head down on the desk and they're exhausted because it's hard to be on for 3 hours and be present. And we honestly, in our daily parenting lives, don't do that a whole lot. And so we think about, you know, sometimes moms come back and sometimes they're not successful. Sometimes the barriers are too great and we grapple with that issue a lot. And you know, do you feel like it's a failure or what does that mean, essentially? And then we reflect back on the fact that we are all, you know, like products that were a big cake mix and what goes into that mix. And so what went into that mix will never be taken back out. So they did have that year or those 2 years where they had a mom who was sober, who was present, who was playful, who was there. And that is now a part of them no matter what happens. And obviously we always hope for success. But what happens with the children is also that they're no longer alone, that they're no longer think that they're the only ones who don't have their mom come to school during, you know, have lunch with your mom day, that they are not the only ones who have to leave visits and say goodbye to their mom when they desperately want to be with her. They can't go and she can't go and they can't stay. And so they form a community with one another that, you know, normalizes what is a very difficult situation for them. A lot of reduction in their anxiety. We have the ability to bring the kids inside of the secure perimeter, as they call it. So they're actually walking across the prison yard and they go into a building where their mom goes to school or takes classes. They can see the building where she lives. They see that she has friends. They see what the food that she eats, that she's healthy. All of these things are important. We've created a book so that the kids can see where their mom lives. They can pictures of the housing units that was all approved by the facility. So having the visual, being able to touch and feel and see and snuggle and take your shoes off and just be with your mom in a more organic way than is able to happen in the visiting room are all very powerful things. And what we believe happens then is that the part of the brain that the child has that's really consumed with anxiety is now opened up and available to learn and to grow and to thrive. And that's our hope.
Jessica, what needs to happen? You're serving just a handful of women in custody who are moms. What needs to happen to serve more women behind the bars?
So I'm actively looking for funding to really establish the Family Resource Center. I think that would be a great vehicle to serve more women. Women could definitely benefit from the deeper intervention of the Family Preservation Project, but certainly a lot of women could be served well through shorter interventions and through less of an intervention. Like I had mentioned, that phone call to a DHS caseworker or facilitating a phone call to a family member, and we've seen life-changing events happen through very little, you know, just for creating that bridge. Prison builds a wall between families, and that wall doesn't serve families well. And so even to establish the Family Resource Center, we would be able to serve a lot more women. Community partners to come and be a part of the Speakers Bureau. We've had tremendous people. We've had tremendous response, but we're always looking for people that can come and offer their expertise or their services to the women there through the Speakers Bureau. We would be able to serve 150 women a month at capacity. And then the Family Resource Center as well. So there are things or components of our program that are supported through our contract with the Department of Corrections. And there are pieces of our program that we're very committed to that are not.
Where can this money come from?
interested parties can write a check. We have a fund set up so that we can receive donations. We write small grants. We have had an anonymous donor in the past. So really a variety of sources, local community organizations, individuals, foundations.
And we will post that address on the KABU Prison Pipeline webpage.
Great.
Ava Guzman, so what do you see for your future with your children?
I see me being a positive influence and being able to be there for them, being the mother that they need, somebody that they can come to and talk to, and being able to just be a part of their lives. I'm definitely a better woman now. I think that without the Family Preservation Project, I would probably still be lost. What I learned in the Family Preservation Project and while I was incarcerated, I use outside of those walls, and I use today.
Jessica Katz and Aaron Webb from the Family Preservation Project, thank you so much for being here. Thank you, Eva. You have been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you, Danielle Parks, our engineer. Good night.
Native American Business Network is holding its 12th annual Trading at the River Conference and Native Marketplace at Lewis and Clark College, May 27th through the 29th. ONABEN is a nonprofit public benefit corporation created by Northwest Tribes to increase the success of private businesses owned by Native Americans. Trading at the River features inspirational speakers, informative panels, and valuable workshops for small business owners and economic development organizations. ONABEN also welcomes community members to come check out the Native Marketplace, a highlight of the event, which features over 20 Native vendors. It is open to the public from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., May 29th at Lewis and Clark College at Smith Hall. More information about this KBOOT-sponsored event may be found on kboo.fm.